Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, as the case may be. My name is Alan Fanger, and I am a longtime litigation attorney based in the Boston area. I'm also the founder and CEO of Empower Legal, Inc., which is the first ever and only company to provide an online video training platform for clients who are involved in litigation. Our web address is www.empowerlegal.net, and feel free to go to the website where you can watch trailers of videos on deposition preparation, trial preparation, and mediation preparation. I'm going to talk today mostly about how to effectively prepare your clients for deposition, but I'm also going to spend some time at the end talking about some trial preparation and mediation preparation tips. Now, let's start with depositions. And the problem with depositions from the beginning is one of perception. You might recall that among all the press conferences that President Trump has given about the Russia investigation, there was a press conference where he essentially said, in substance, I'm looking forward to talking with Special Counsel Mueller. I'm really looking forward to it, and I intend to tell him exactly what I think. Now, the import of that statement is really applicable to just about all deposition preparation, because clients, at least at the beginning, have a perception that a deposition affords them an opportunity to somehow improve their lot in a particular case. And why not, right? Because our instincts tell us that if someone sits us down and has a conversation with us, that we have the capacity to be able to persuade that person of our position. And how do we do that? We do that by, you know, explaining, defending, arguing, interrupting, all the things that human instinct would tell us to do. Well, human instinct has no place in a deposition. So at the beginning, when you receive a deposition notice indicating that your client has to appear for a deposition, the first conversation that you have with your client is to disabuse them of all the notions that they may have about a deposition. And the one overarching principle that from which so many other what I call sub-principles fall is that a deposition is not a normal conversation. And all the instincts that one could bring to conversation need to be completely abandoned. The best way to describe a deposition is a managed dialogue. In a normal conversation, we interrupt each other and the like. There are no interruptions here, no explanations, no arguments. This is controlled and deliberate. So once you've gotten the notice, you call the client, maybe have the client in for an initial meeting, and you say, this is what's going to happen. You then have to set out the goals for any deposition. And the first goal is for the client to limit harm to his or her, in the corporation context, its position in the case. Again, that seems somewhat counterintuitive, but the client needs to know up front that the case they have or the defense they have never looks better than when it's on paper. And after that deposition is over, the case or the defense, not going to look quite as good, but that's okay. So for purposes of trying to calm the client's anxiety, it's really important to say, look, you know what? After this deposition is over, your case won't look the same. Okay, but that's all right, because I am going to take the deposition of the plaintiff or the defendant. And after I'm done, their position is not going to look nearly as good as it looked before we started. So the client is really best off thinking that their goal should be to limit the harm to their position in a way that is more effective than the other side. In other words, it's almost like you're saying, hey, look, you know, we know you're not going to do perfectly, okay? But hopefully you can be less imperfect than the other side. That's a good way to think about it. And I think that once the client thinks in those terms, they can feel like they're in what I call a zone of safety, that whatever mistakes they make at a deposition are mistakes that the client can live with. The other goals of a deposition are that the client needs to convey the impression of being credible. So the client's being judged. The client's being judged by opposing counsel, and in some cases in a personal injury or products liability or a malpractice context, they're being judged by the defendant's insurer. And people are going to be looking at that transcript, perhaps observing the client testify live, and they're going to make credibility determinations that may affect their view of whether the case gets tried, gets settled, gets mediated. So it's really important for the client to appear credible. Part of appearing credible is being prepared. And because if your client is not prepared, then several conclusions can be drawn from that lack of preparation. Number one, the client maybe is not as interested in seeing the case through to a conclusion as they should be. Number two is you as counsel may not be sufficiently invested in the case, may not have done your diligence so as to prepare your client. And three, lack of preparation is a strategic advantage for the other side. And the other side may say, well, client's not that prepared. Let's see if we can take advantage of that. Let's perhaps consider trying the case. So preparation is hugely important. And, I can recount so many instances over the course of 32 years where I've been, I take a deposition and the client arrives or the opposite party arrives at my office and I ask them, can I get you coffee or water? And they'll say, yeah, sure, fine. And I'll say, let me know when your attorney gets here. And quite frequently they'll say, oh, sure. They'll say sort of half jokingly, I don't know who he is. I don't know what he looks like, but I'm sure I'll be able to find him when he gets here. And what does that tell you? That tells you that opposing counsel is not taking the process seriously. Any good preparation of a client for a deposition should be a methodical, lengthy process that involves, I think, multiple meetings and extensive review of documents that may be presented to the client during the deposition. You can't simply short shrift preparation by showing up at the deposition on the day of the deposition, taking a half hour to meet with a very anxious client in a conference room and giving them last minute instructions. It just doesn't work that way. The clients are simply too anxious and they need time to be able to appreciate the process, prepare for it, and deal with the inevitable anxiety. Let's talk for a moment about myths that you're going to need to debunk in preparing a client for a deposition. The instinct, as I said, is for a client to explain or want to explain everything. There are no explanations to be offered up at a deposition unless an open-ended question is asked that calls for an open-ended answer. And even then, the answer that's rendered needs to be controlled. So the client really needs to be disabused of that notion right away. No explanations. Client might also say, well, after they get done with me, they'll want to settle. Well, that may be the case. You're going to have to travel a road in order to get there. You're going to have to appear credible, confident, prepared, and maybe that will help to push the case toward settlement. But the client shouldn't assume that. And the minute the client starts assuming that is the minute that the client gets complacent and quite possibly short shrifts their own preparation. The client might say, well, I'm going to do great. Really going to do great because I tend to shine in these kinds of situations. Well, again, that may be the case. But complacency is at the root of all evil when it comes to deposition preparation. So there's nothing wrong with the client feeling confident, but there is some line to be drawn between being confident and being cocky. And that line is one that can't be crossed. Some clients, believe it or not, believe that you'll be able to help them answer the questions. And of course, it's not an open book exam, and the spontaneity of the exam is what makes it so difficult in terms of preparation and anticipation and performance. So you cannot be in a position to help them answer the questions, though, as we'll talk about in a moment, your presence does carry with it a lot of protection for the client. So when we talk about deposition preparation, we have a client who is a living, breathing person, and we are a helping profession. And it's very easy to forget that these are people, even those who are associated with institutions, these are people with anxieties and fears and apprehensions. And every client brings to the table a slightly different profile in terms of how tolerant or averse they are going to be with this process. Not all clients are created equal. And each client has a different deposition tolerance. And it right away, just the notion of sitting in a deposition may provoke some clients to, for instance, go onto YouTube or Google and try to research what a deposition is. And who knows, maybe they'll end up seeing Bill Gates's deposition, probably the most famous deposition of all time. And these kinds of research undertakings can enhance client anxiety. So again, at this first conversation, this first meeting, a very simple question can be appropriately asked to the client, and that is, what makes you scared about this? What is it about this process? Is it the mystery of it? Is it the fact that you're going to be sitting in a room and you're going to have people looking at you and a court reporter taking down everything you say? Is it your fear that you may testify in a way that harms your position? Regardless of the source of that anxiety, you really need to ferret out where that's coming from. Because when you figure out the source of the client's anxiety, that can lead you to tailor your preparation for the deposition accordingly. So if, for instance, a client has performance anxiety, you can rehearse more of the client's testimony than you would normally, or maybe try to give them some tips on mindfulness, on focusing more about the process than the result. And that's really important. Now, we all know that there are people who perform really, really well under pressure. And there may be some Red Sox fans who are listening to this, and I happen to be from Boston, so I think I can say this with a great degree of fairness and balance, but Derek Jeter, the longtime shortstop of the New York Yankees, was a terrific clutch pressure player under pressure. And if you go onto YouTube, you see innumerable video clips of him making plays when the spotlight was the hottest, namely in the postseason. By contrast, there was a place kicker for the Minnesota Vikings named Blair Walsh. And in a wild card game against the Seattle Seahawks, he had a 27-yard field goal, which we would consider to be a chip shot. Many, many high school players could make that field goal. And he not only missed it, he missed it badly. This was a field goal that would have won the wild card game for the Vikings and sent them to the divisional round. This is about 4 years ago. And he just flat out hooked it. Now, was he having a bad day? If it weren't a playoff game, would he have made it? Who knows? But this was an instance in which someone could be described as choking under pressure. It was a playoff game. There was a lot riding on the line. If he missed it, they lost. If he made it, they won. So the question is your client going to be more like Derek Jeter or Blair Walsh? And I think that the client needs to know that if they are well prepared, they are going to do just fine. They really are. And in that regard, it's important to really consider what makes or what factor can most lead to good performance at a deposition other than preparation? And when we take a look at the body of academic work about how people perform under pressure, the one thing that really comes up over and over again is the need for people to focus on the process and not the result. So the way that plays out in the real world is that if a client keeps thinking about that a particular answer may affect the ultimate result of the case, then the client is going to be distracted, perhaps testify inaccurately, get overly anxious, and have memory lapses. Whereas if the client thinks more about the process, just going through and focusing on answering the questions without thinking about the implications of those answers, the client is likely to perform more effectively. So now that you've had this first conversation with the client, let's say that the client comes into your office. You've had a phone conversation with them. They come into your office. You're going to have your first deposition preparation session. So what do you do at that session? Well, hopefully you have had them watch a DVD or a video, perhaps an online video about how depositions are conducted. And that will give the client the basics, the infrastructure of the deposition. But in case the client does not do that, what you have to do is start with the general and move to the specific. So you basically start by explaining to the client, here's what a deposition is. The other side has the absolute right to take your deposition. That deposition is in the form of an oral exam before a court reporter who will be taking down your testimony under oath, and that testimony is ultimately going to be reduced to a little booklet called a transcript. And that transcript can be used against you for various purposes, whether it be summary judgment, trial, even some prejudgment remedies. So the client needs to understand that the primary purposes of a deposition are to obtain the facts from them, freeze their story so that in case there's a trial, there'll be no any departure from the testimony in any meaningful way may have implications for the client. And of course, to assess the client's credibility, confidence, and preparation. And believe it or not, it's important for the client to know what everybody does in that deposition room. So for instance, does the court reporter talk? The court reporter just sit there? What's the court reporter going to do? Is he or she going to take down everything that I say? How do they take it down? Is it a stenographic machine? Is it voice repetition? Not a seldom used technique now. And how do they ensure that what I say is taken down accurately? And are we on the record the whole time? When do we go off the record? How do I know when we're on or off the record? And how about, am I chained to the chair? Do I get to take breaks? Can I bring water into the deposition? Can I bring food into the deposition? Can I bring my notes? Well, you definitely don't want to do that. Like I said, it's not an open book exam. And of course, the client should know that whatever written materials they bring in are fair game for deposing counsel. I actually had a deposition just a few weeks ago where the deponent brought in a notepad. The notepad was a legal pad with probably 20 pages of writings and notes on it. And he had to turn that legal pad over to me during the deposition. And I went through the legal pad and I was able to find some great nuggets to use against him. So the client should be sitting there with nothing more than perhaps a water bottle or a drink, maybe some snacks. And if the client wants to bring a legal pad with them, they can certainly do so. But I wouldn't recommend that the client do anything with that legal pad other than perhaps write down some things during a break. Okay. So the issue of breaks presents an interesting question. At least here in Massachusetts, if the deponent wants a break, custom and practice say that that break is to be accommodated unless there's a question pending. Your jurisdiction may have different rules about that, but I rarely want a client to be sitting in the hot seat for more than about an hour and 15 minutes or so. Why do I come up with that figure? Well, that's about the time that clients get mentally fatigued. And I don't want my client, when we get to the hour and 15 minute mark, being susceptible to mistakes because he or she is tired. So what I will typically do after about an hour and 15 minutes is that if the client doesn't want a break, I will ask for a break, which is perfectly reasonable, right? Now, the question is, are you permitted to talk to your client during a break where you're both outside the deposition room? Again, your jurisdiction may have rules that differ from Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, there's no prohibition against talking with the client while you were at a break in a deposition outside the deposition room. And I actually take that break as an opportunity to speak with the client, talk to them about anticipated lines of questioning that may be coming up, also sort of debrief on some things they may have testified to that might need to be corrected. So now that we've talked about breaks and food and water, transportation to the deposition should be something that does not give the client anxiety at all. So whatever is in front of the client that day, other than the deposition itself, should be something that is extremely user-friendly for the client. So let's say that you and the client live sort of near one another and you can drive to opposing counsel's office. I always recommend that that I pick up the client and drive the client to the deposition. Now, you might say, well, that's not a big deal. Well, it's just one less thing that the client needs to deal with. Imagine this. You're the client's driving to the deposition. The client is actually stuck in traffic. It's anxiety provoking. It's frustrating. There's a three car accident and the four lane highway is reduced down to one lane and now the client's going to be a half hour late to the deposition. Well, you can imagine, and because this has happened many a time, that the client gets the deposition and he or she is flustered, just completely frustrated and exhausted and in no way a candidate to sit and give really good deposition testimony. So better that you be the one driving and dealing with the frustrations of sitting in traffic than the client. So then you have to explain what your role as counsel is. Now, instinct might suggest that, well, again, you're sitting next to me. I'm sure you'll give me an elbow. You'll give me signs. You'll somehow coach me. And you've got to give the client the strong impression that you can't coach them. You're not there to coach them. However, you are there to protect them. You're there to protect them in a number of ways. First of all, your ability to make objections for the record is very important. And of course, another thing that you need to do as part of the sort of general preparation is to explain to them objections. Your particular jurisdiction may have different rules about objections. Here in Massachusetts, we generally stipulate that all objections except as to the form of question and motions to strike are reserved until trial. In whatever jurisdiction you're in, you need to explain to the client what the likely stipulations are going to be so that the client understands that when you're objecting, why you're objecting, okay? So you're not only there to make objections, preserve the record, but you're also there to protect them against getting roughed up. They really need to know that you are not open season for every question under the sun. Now, having said that, there are, we're all over the map, literally, when it comes to rules about whether you can instruct a client not to answer a deposition question because you believe it is burdensome, not discoverable, overbroad, et cetera, what I call the non-privileged objections. Here in Massachusetts, for instance, I think we follow the lead of a number of states that provide that you're not permitted to do that, but you are permitted to suspend the deposition and seek relief. And what I frequently do is if I think that a client is getting roughed up, that counsel is going into areas that are not discoverable, that are really where you've got questions that are really put out there to harass or embarrass the client. What I typically do is I offer to suspend the deposition and get a protective order. And I would say about 95% of the time, opposing counsel simply relents and says, you know what, I'm going to move on to the next question, but I'm reserving on it. You know, so that's a perfectly valid strategy. The issue of privilege objections is also something that needs to be brought to the fore with the client, because when there is a privilege objection made, you're going to give very specific instructions to the client, and the client needs to know how those instructions are going to sound to them. So, for instance, I have a standard privilege objection, which states in substance, objection, attorney-client privilege. You may not answer the question if the question calls upon you to reveal communications that you've had with counsel. If you can answer the question without revealing communications with counsel, you must answer the question. And so once the client understands the sort of cadence of that objection, he or she can really get a feel for how they need to answer it. And that's something you need to definitely rehearse with the client. Now, for Rule 30b-6 designees, there is an additional set of instructions that are really, really important to give. And I can't tell you how many times I run into this either when taking a deposition or defending a deposition involving a 30B6 deponent, where you have, let's back up for a minute and talk about the obligations of the designee. So the case law in nearly every state, and of course this is very clear in the federal system, is that a 30B6 designee is speaking for the corporation. And in connection with their obligation to speak on behalf of the corporation, the designee has an obligation to gather the facts from whatever source is possible so that the designee can answer questions that correspond to the matters that are designated in the Rule 30b-6 deposition notice. So that puts on the designee a significant burden, because a 30b-6 deposition notice may have 10, 15, 20, 25 matters on which the designee is called upon to testify. Those matters could be very general in nature. And what I see so often is designees come to the deposition and then they're asked a question about, say, item 6 or the matter number 6 that's designated in the 30B6 deposition notice, and they sort of give a response like, huh? As if they were, you know, hit by a Mack truck. So it's really important that the designee, if anything, overgather the information so that they are not having to be brought back.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is POLICE, POLICE, POLICE. Esquire CLE's first verification code is POLICE, POLICE, POLICE. Please take a moment and write this down.
Again, as is so often the case, where a designee is simply not able to answer a question. Now, client might say, well, you know, I know I'm going to be asked questions, but what can they ask me? Can they ask me anything? Can they go into my, you know, deepest, darkest past and, you know, find out like every place I've ever worked and who my boss was? And so in that regard, it's really important that clients understand the difference between discoverability and relevancy, because clients have an instinct that says, oh, they're only permitted to ask me questions that are relevant. Well, maybe they wouldn't use the word relevant, but they'd use maybe the word or a description like, well, they're only obligated to ask me questions about anything having to do with the case. And again, here's where deposition is counterintuitive, and the client really needs to understand that discoverability is a far, far more expansive playing field than relevancy. And you need to really assure the client that, look, yes, Discoverability cuts a far, far bigger footprint than relevancy, and you may be asked questions that you think are not or don't have anything to do with the issues in the case. But I'm here to tell you that there is, in fact, a larger area that's covered by discoverability, and what you may think is not discoverable is, in fact, quite possibly discoverable. But beyond that, if I, as your counsel, and by the way, I, as your counsel, I'm going to be the one to make determinations as to what's discoverable, right? And if I see that what's being asked is not discoverable, then I'm going to take whatever steps I can take to make sure that you're protected, whether that means an instruction not to answer if your jurisdiction permits it, or an offer to suspend and get a protective order in jurisdictions that require that particular procedure. So we talked about stipulations and objections. The client needs to really know that. Then the client needs to really understand what it means to amend answers, right? So answers can be amended, right? This should be a relief to a client. But there is, there are preferred processes for amending answers. And I think that that really is in sort of descending order. One, amending the answer during examination by counsel. Number two, doing it in your own examination of your client. And number three, the least preferable version is the errata sheet. Right? Now, why do I theorize this? Right? First of all, amending during examination by counsel actually often leads to the conclusion that, the client realized almost immediately that their answer was inaccurate or incomplete. And the immediacy with which that's corrected tends to show that the client understood, like, right away, and that it was, in fact, a legitimate mistake on the client's part. Now, if the amendment is made during your examination, it looks more contrived. It looks like, well, you had a chance to really consider it, and you spoke with your counsel, and you, after reflection and being able to deliberate with counsel, you decided to answer it at that point. Now, that can be brought out at trial. And then the least preferable option is to correct testimony by way of an errata sheet. Now, just about every jurisdiction permits the use of an errata sheet to correct testimony. But errata sheets with answers that are changed substantively, whether it's, you know, a yes to a no or otherwise, errata sheets are more likely than anything else to lead to requests to bring the client back for further deposition testimony. And I, in my years of practice, have done that frequently. In fact, on the morning that I'm recording this, I got an errata sheet back from a defendant in a case, and he made no less than about 75 corrections on his errata sheet. Well, he is probably coming back for further testimony, and I suspect that a judge, if there's some resistance to that effort, is going to be favorably inclined to let that happen. The client also needs to understand that what they are doing in the deposition is simply another layer of statements or testimony that in the end needs to align itself consistently with responses to written discovery requests and trial testimony. In the perfect world, that the statement is made, any statement made under oath in an interrogatory answer, response to a request for admission, in a declaration, in an affidavit, in the perfect world, that is perfectly layered on top of, or the deposition testimony is layered on top of those responses, and the trial testimony is layered on top of the deposition testimony, so that there are, in fact, two distinct opportunities for impeachment. One is impeachment of the written discovery responses if they don't align with the deposition. That takes place, of course, at the deposition. And then a trial, if the trial testimony differs from the deposition testimony or the answers made under oath to written discovery or in declarations or affidavits. So the answer, or the key in trying to preserve this alignment, is preparation. It starts with a review of documents prior to the depot, and review of interrogatory answers, responses to requests for admission, to declarations, affidavits, a verified complaint, if that is used in your jurisdiction, and preparation is the best antidote against that misalignment happening. Now, when we talk about answering deposition questions, we need to be realistic. The client really, and you as counsel preparing the client, should not be sugarcoating anything about the preparation. The client should know right out front that this will be an uncomfortable exercise. Okay? I mean, I really do appreciate when I go in for any kind of medical procedure, I appreciate it when the nurse, the anesthesiologist, the doctor says, you know, what you're going to experience is 5 seconds of pain. Okay? Like I had a procedure done on my eye. There was a mole on my eyelid, and it was taken out, and the procedure took 5 minutes. During the 5 minute procedure, there was about 10 seconds when it was extraordinarily painful, and the surgeon told me in advance, you're going to feel about 10 seconds of pain. And I have to tell you, I really appreciated knowing that, because I could get prepared for it. So the client needs to know that, look, it's not going to be comfortable. This is not something you would do voluntarily. It's the functional equivalent of having to go in front of the media for a press conference. So a certain degree of discomfort is normal and expected. And actually, if the client's not uncomfortable, you would sort of scratch your head and say, whoa, maybe you're not focusing on the task at hand here, because a little bit of nervousness is okay, and a little bit of discomfort is perfectly fine. The client will also feel a periodic or even frequent or persistent loss or lack of control, because they're not in control of much of anything except how they answer the questions. The cadence of the questions, the content of the questions, the number of the questions, and the subject of the questions are all within the control of deposing counsel, subject to your regulation to the extent you're able to regulate it. But clients who see a meaningful ability to control the deposition process are really going to end up in a lot of trouble. I think the best way to think about it is to say to the client, you know what, you're going to feel a loss of control, but I am here to make sure things don't get out of control. That's the best way to look at it. The deposition will also feature frequent instances in which the client admits or makes concessions that are against their interest. And this harkens back to what I said at the beginning of the program about focusing on process and not getting caught up in the result or the implications of the testimony. One of the purposes of the deposition is to narrow issues in the case and acquire facts. And that necessarily results in the client having to testify in ways that appear to be against their interest. The client's really better off thinking of it in a different way, that the client's going to give answers that are against their interest. In most instances, those answers are already known by the other side. So for instance, a document's put in front of the client. Client signed it, no dispute about that. Client's asked, you know, you signed this, did you not? Answer, yes. That's not really an answer that's against interest. That's just reinforcement of something that's already known by the other side. So if the client can understand that they are going to make these repeated admissions and concessions that are against their interest, but that it will not harm their position, then the client can feel more comfortable about the fact that they're going to do that. Back to explanations. Again, attempts to explain around questions usually fail. Clients are often asked to give explanations that essentially are explanations of things that are already known. And if a client attempts to sort of tweak it or spin it, that's usually something that they're going to be caught on at some point during the deposition. And debating, arguing, and grandstanding obviously is a recipe for complete and utter disaster. I have seen so many instances over the course of 32 years in which my own clients, in which opposing parties have launched into soliloquies or diatribes about various things, and the transcript is littered with page upon page of just almost like a filibuster, which can prove to be disastrous. So clients really need to understand that there's no place for debate and argument and grandstanding and deposition. And of course, telling the truth should be paramount. If the client can walk away from your prep session or prep sessions with even one thing to take with them, it's to tell the truth. The client should know that if they do not testify truthfully, that harm is going to befall them in some way, shape, or form, that they must assume that opposing counsel is thoroughly prepared, and if a client testifies falsely on a particular matter, that they're going to be subject to being impeached by something in a document, by maybe a testimony of a third party, by something that they have said under oath in a declaration or affidavit or a written discovery response that's 180 degrees contrary to their deposition testimony. So truth is the currency for any deposition. Now, clients, of course, know they're going to have to answer a lot of questions, but really a deposition is as much of a listening exercise as it is a speaking exercise. In instances where there is no video camera that is trained on the client, the transcript's not going to pick up how long they take to answer a question. So what I always tell clients when I'm preparing them for a deposition is, you know what? Just listen to the question, first of all. And if you don't understand the question, ask that it be rephrased. You know, when when I take depositions, I will almost always at the beginning say to the deponent, if you don't understand a question I've asked, please ask me to rephrase it. Otherwise, I will assume that you understood it. That's very effective. And so assuming that the client understands the question, okay, now they're listening. They're sort of sitting back. They're not hunched over the table, sort of nervously, sort of leaning a little bit back in their chair, and they're receiving the question, they're listening to it, and then they can think about how they're going to answer. Again, if there's no video camera trained on the client has the opportunity, without cost to them, to really think and consider the answer. And then after they have considered how to answer it, then and only then should they answer the question. And I think you'll find actually some really, really good videos out there of politicians and athletes who, of course, give more press conferences than anybody else. But there are any number of famous politicians and famous athletes. For instance, President Obama was probably the master of listening to a question at a press conference and then answering deliberately. You rarely saw Obama sort of speak extemporaneously at a press conference. He always chose his words very carefully. And your client should really do the same. This is a deliberative dialogue where the client has an opportunity to really think about how to answer and then answer the question in a managed way, just understanding that whatever they say is being picked up by the court reporter. And believe it or not, many questions can be answered with a yes, simple yes or no. And I, of course, this is probably the greatest frustration that we all feel when we have clients who are sitting in a deposition and you know, questions are asked and they're very simple questions. They call for yes or no answers and clients are incapable of answering them yes or no. But that doesn't mean that you can't reinforce for the client that if a question calls for a yes or no answer, that they answer it yes or no. I'd like to see the techniques for answering questions is really boiling down to the six C's. So the first is being concise. Being concise means you answer the question using the fewest amount of words and expending the least amount of energy. So I like to tell the clients, and this is in our deposition preparation video, where we say, you know, one of the useful techniques for a client is simply close their eyes and just say over and over again, yes, no, that's correct, yes, no, so that they condition in their mind to have this instinct to answer concisely. Part of being concise is not to ramble and not to explain and not to argue or debate. Again, this is all counterintuitive, but it's all capable of being mastered by the client at a prep session or sessions. But being clear is also very important, the second C of the six C's. By clear, I mean being not only speaking clearly, but also making sure that your answers aren't ambiguous at all, that you are, that the client is actually articulating something that is understandable by the other side. You would think, oh, that's not an issue, but quite frequently it is. Credibility, we've discussed that a moment ago, and that's just paramount, that the client be credible. Confident. The client, as we said earlier, is being judged. Clients being judged on their credibility, but also on their preparation and their confidence. How confident do they look? There are ways of using your body language to look confident. I like to have my clients leaning back just a bit, having their hands crossed in front of them. Some clients end up putting their hand in front of their mouth, which I find to be annoying and also a defense mechanism. And that can be picked up as a sign of nervousness or concern about credibility or anxiety. So if possible, really work on body language with your clients to make sure that they at least give the look of being confident, if not the air of being confident. Answers must be careful. Client cannot guess. Now, there is a difference between a guess and a best memory. A best memory is something in that cues the client into thinking that that something is accurate. So, for instance, the client is asked, well, what time of day was it that the accident happened? Well, they might not be able to pinpoint the exact time, but they do know that they were driving on the freeway and there was a what we call a solar slowdown. So they were driving into a setting sun. So let's say that this occurred sometime in November. They might say, well, it was around 4 o'clock because, you know, the sun, at least in our part of the world, starts to set around 4 o'clock. So that would be a best memory. A guess is something that is just pulled out of thin air. It's almost random. And the client cannot get involved in guessing because, again, guessing exposes them as possibly not being credible. So, again, if in this hypothetical accident scenario, client might be asked, you know, where did you have dinner the prior night? Did you have anything to drink? Where were you the prior night? And you might remember you were out to dinner, but you have no memory as to what you were doing the prior night. So you might say, "Oh, I was at this event." Well, they might be able to prove that you weren't at the event. So guessing is in and of itself very hazardous. But what about "I don't know" and "I don't remember"? Now, the human brain has only so much capacity. And memory deficiencies are always understandable, particularly for people who are older. And, you know, we can only cram so much information in our heads. So I don't remember is not a bad answer. And I don't know is not a bad answer, as long as A, the client legitimately does not know or does not remember, and B, it's not used as a crutch. And what do I mean by that? Well, we all know about selective memory. And for instance, I was deposing somebody in a piece of probate litigation a few weeks ago. And I asked the client, you know, did you hire a broker to sell the property? And I was asking about something that happened about 10 years ago. And this is property of which they were a trustee of a real estate trust. And the deponent said, well, I don't remember whether I hired a broker or not. Later on in the deposition, I asked the deponent about some conversations he had had at around the same time, and his memory of those conversations was quite vivid because he was explaining things that were, at least in his mind, in his interest. So what does that do? That creates a problem of selective memory. You have a deponent who can remember a conversation that took place about 10 years earlier, but couldn't remember the significant event, whether they had, or a significant question of whether they had hired a broker to sell the property for them, property that they...
Esquire CLE's second verification code is ECHO, E-C-H-O, ECHO. Esquire CLE's second verification code is ECHO, E-C-H-O, ECHO. Please take a moment and write this down.
Knew intimately well because they were the trustee of a real estate trust. So I don't know and I don't remember should not be used as a crutch. That's very dangerous. Let's talk about methods of deposition preparation. You have an array of methods that can be used. I often go to conventions and conferences and trade shows where I speak. And when I'm at those conventions and trade shows, I frequently ask colleagues, wherever I am, well, how do you go about preparing clients for a deposition? And most of them will say, well, they come into my office the day before or the day of, and I sit with them and I give them verbal instructions. Well, my next question is, well, are they able to follow those instructions in the deposition? And quite frequently, colleagues will say, well, not all the time. And then, you know, when I really get to talking with them, they say, I get very frustrated that my verbal instructions are not followed. And verbal instructions, or approaching a deposition with verbal-only preparation is problematic. There was a psychologist in the 1940s named Edgar Dale. And I say this somewhat reluctantly because I'm a Michigan grad and a proud alumnus of the University of Michigan. And Edgar Dale was a professor at Ohio State. And Edgar Dale postulated through his research that human beings remember about 20% of what they hear, 30% of what they see, and 50% of what they see and hear. Now, Professor Dale is correct, and even though he's an Ohio State professor, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt, as have all these academics over the last six decades or so. If Professor Dale is correct, then verbal preparation is about 20% effective and getting the client to comply with deposition preparation processes. A client, you know, whatever you say, about 20% of that is going to filter down to the client. Would you ever want the client to only remember 20% of what you told them in preparation for a deposition? I would think not. And another preparation protocol that is used are handouts. Now, handouts, again, that's a little more effective because, of course, Professor Dale notes that we remember about 20% of what we see or read. So the client will have something more permanent in their hands, a handout, maybe something you email to them. But again, that's going to result in them remembering about 30% of your instructions. Would you want the client to remember only 30% of your instructions? I think not. But there are some really good handouts some of them from the ABA. If you're a member of AAJ or DRI or some, you know, specialty bars such as NELA, you may have some really good handouts that you can give to the client. Then there's video training, which consists of DVDs or for some people VHS tapes, e-learning platforms such as my company's e-learning platform, and YouTube videos. And those are really falling into the 50% or more category from Professor Dale's theory. That's whatever the client sees and hears at the same time, they're going to remember 50% or more of those instructions. And that, I submit, is a much better percentage for the client going into the deposition. Now, you have the client that either listens to your verbal instructions, reads it, and or reads a handout, and or watches a video. After the client has done that, it's really important that you perform a mock deposition with the client. And that mock deposition actually fulfills a number of purposes. Number one, it gets the client used to the cadence of the deposition. That's really important. Also gets the client to understand how privilege objections would be handled, how they can deal with getting roughed up, and also the way in which their memory is tested. And in doing this mock deposition, there's really no substitute for spending some time trying to anticipate the lines of questioning and asking questions that are consistent with those anticipated areas of inquiry. I don't think it does the client any service to simply throw up a bunch of softball questions because that doesn't simulate game conditions. It's really important that you try to get the client to feel the kind of discomfort and get used to the feeling of making admissions and concessions against their interest that's going to take place when they sit down for the actual deposition. So this requires you to sort of really get granular with the facts. And you don't have to come up with every single question. You're not going to be able to come up with every single question that your opponent is going to ask. But if you can bullet point a number of different factual areas and then turn around and take those areas and convert them into really hard questions, you will have done your client a major service in advance of the deposition day. So here's a good timeline to follow. It's a timeline that I use with my clients and have used with a great deal of success. What I typically do is right after I get a deposition notice, I either email the client or have a brief phone call with them. We talk about what the client needs to review in the way of documents or answers to written discovery, declarations, affidavits, and the client starts right away to review all that stuff. I then have the client view my company's deposition video, and they do that right away. So they get comfortable with the facts and they get comfortable with the process. Then about a week prior to the deposition, we meet in the office. We review the anticipated lines of questioning. I ask the client to view the depo video a second time. The first time, I just want them to understand the infrastructure of the deposition. The second time, I want them to focus on the techniques for answering as are depicted in the video. They then view the deposition a second time, and I then ask them to come in about two days prior to the deposition, sometimes three, and we do a mock deposition in the office. We do a critique. Every once in a while, I will videotape them. I think that is particularly in cases where there's a lot riding on the line. I think that videotaping and going over things like body language and the like is useful doing it in the video context. I ask the client to view the deposition video a third time, one day prior to the deposition. And then the night before, I really want the client to focus on relaxing. So I just say, look, go get a good night's sleep, watch a funny movie, and purge your brain of everything, because what you don't want to do is have your client doing some last minute cramming that typically only contributes to anxiety. So that That is my concluding remarks about deposition. So much of this can be applied to trial preparation. I think one of the differences with trial preparation is there are a lot of moving parts in a trial. And so much of what we take for granted at a trial is something the client cannot really easily understand without seeing how the trial process works. So when I have a client who is going to trial in the case, the first thing I want them to do is I want them to actually visit the courthouse and the courtroom in which the trial is going to take place in advance of the trial. So what we usually do is we go over mid to late afternoon after the session, particular session, is done for the day, and we walk into that courtroom, and I point out where everybody is going to be sitting and what everybody is going to be doing. It's really important, and it makes the client much more at ease. And then what I do is I explain everything that's going to go on in terms of procedure and style. So we talk, for instance, about how the jury is going to be selected. We also have a trial video, which we can have the client watch in advance of the trial. And either in the video or live in the courtroom, we show how the jury is selected, if it's a jury case. We talk about peremptory challenges and challenges for cause. And then we talk about the opening statements and what their purpose is. And then we talk about evidence and objections. So the client should understand basically, what is involved, and the difference between discoverability and relevancy and the guidelines, the general guidelines that the judge is going to use in making decisions on objections at trial. We talk about the importance of present recollection refreshed, and how if you don't know the answer to a question, but that your document might refresh your recollection, talk about how that's done. We talk about what to do when objections are made. If an objection is made, you have to wait until the judge rules on the objection. We talk about sidebar conferences. What are the attorneys doing over at the sidebar? We talk about closing statements. And of course, we talk about jury instructions and jury questions, and then how the verdict is delivered. And then once the client knows that infrastructure, you can work on preparing them for direct and cross-examination testimony. And on direct, your client is telling a story, all right? And you need to give the client an opportunity to tell that story. And humanizing the client, unless it's a business case, but sometimes even in business cases, is really important. On cross-exam, preparation is so much of what the client needs to do to effectively testify and cross, and again, understand that their testimony is to a large extent a product of something that's out of their control, that they will almost always be asked questions that the other lawyer knows the answer to. So we like to say that on direct, the client testifies, and on cross, the cross-examining lawyer testifies. And it's really, there's a real kernel of truth to that. So again, I think video training, where you see, you can watch a trial video and see how direct testimony is rendered effectively and how cross-exam is rendered effectively, is really important. Let me just finish up by talking briefly about mediation. It is rare that, or at least it's been historically rare, that attorneys have thought about preparing clients elaborately for a mediation. And I actually think that we do a disservice to our clients when we don't effectively prepare them for mediation. There's a lot that happens at a mediation that can be very mysterious to a client. I had a mediation about 5 years ago where we settled the case. The case was an employment case. It was mediated by a federal magistrate judge. And after about 9 hours of mediation, we get outside. The case has been settled. The client's exhausted. And I asked her, well, what'd you think? And she said, well, I feel like I got hit by a truck and somehow survived. So what did that tell me? It told me that I had probably not prepared her sufficiently for the session. And in response to that, I ended up producing a mediation video to really draw the curtain away on this process and give clients an insight into what happens. So there are a lot of things that happen that a client should really know about. One is there's the idea of this this two-number theory. Now, if we have a damages case, we have a mediation of a damages case, quite frequently, the parties may have exchanged demands or offers prior to the mediation. It's really important that the client go into the mediation with two numbers. The number that they're going to put out there, depending on if they're plaintiff or defendant, typically in a mediation, go in, it's the last party to have not, the last party to have made a demand or offer typically is not the party that would be asked to come up with a number at the mediation. So let's say you're that party, the opposing party was the party that most recently made a demand or an offer. And you're expected to then come back with your number first at a mediation. What the client needs to do is to understand that there's a two-number strategy here. There is a number that you're going to come into the mediation with, the number you're going to put out first, and then there's going to be the number that is the absolute bottom line number below which, if you're a plaintiff, and above which, if you're a defendant, you're not willing to go, even on the best day. Now, that having been said, client really needs to be receptive to what the mediator tells them at the session and to be willing to possibly adjust their bottom line based on particularly evaluative work that's done by the mediator. I like to have mediations with evaluative mediators, not mediators who try to just facilitate things and split the baby. I don't think that's fair to the parties because I think mediation should ultimately be a process where the parties get a chance to really assess the vulnerabilities and strengths of their own position. And that's best done by an evaluative mediator. Other folks may want somebody who's merely a split the baby type, particularly if you've got a defendant who's potentially seriously exposed on a case, and having a mediator who's just willing to split the baby may be beneficial to you. But most of the time, I want evaluative mediators. So getting the client to be realistic and flexible on their expectations with their bottom line is really important going into the session. Clients should also understand that this is a session where they can be heard. They have the opportunity to be heard privately or in a plenary session. And if they have concerns, fears, they feel like some things have not been brought out through mediation briefs or summaries, if the mediator has asked for them, or if the client just wants to let off steam, I think it's important to get preferably in advance of the session for the client to be able to have the opportunity to have the floor and to tell the mediator, knowing that whatever's said to the mediator is said in confidence, to tell the mediator what they think. And by conversely, to be able to listen. As we talked earlier about how a deposition is a good listening exercise, mediation is also an excellent and important listening exercise. Really, really important for the client to be able to listen to the mediator, the opposing party, and opposing counsel. There are tricks of the trade in a mediation, which we all know about. I think the client should know about those too. One is having the mediator serve as a messenger for information. Another is using the mediator as a repository for confidential information, since in nearly all jurisdictions, statements said to a mediator are confidential. Quite often, you can take advantage of that to be able to repose confidences in the mediator that help them understand the client's objectives and the client's position, client's fears, client's anger, client's vulnerabilities, both legally and personally. The other trick of the trade that is I find to be really, really valuable, and clients should know about this, is basically propping the mediator up with their by having an idea that you can designate the mediator to hold ownership of. Now, why is that important? Well, let's say you're getting close. You're in a mediation and a damages case, and you're close on the numbers, but you don't want to convey any kind of desperation. You don't want to play your hand. What I've done in many cases is to have the mediator take ownership of an idea. So I might say, you know, I think my client is willing to settle this case at X dollars. But Mr. Mediator, Ms. Mediator, tell you what, would you go to the other side and say, you know, I can't commit to this and I don't have authority, but I sense that the other side might be willing to settle for X. Can I trust you guys to give me authority at X, and I think I can go back and deliver the goods with the other side? That's a really valuable technique to use at mediation. I think the client should be aware of that. So that concludes my program for today. Again, my website is www.empowerlegal.net, and my email address is Alan, A-L-A-N, at empowerlegal.net. And good luck in preparing your clients for these major litigation events. That concludes my remarks.